May it please the court, my name is Peter Sweeney. I'm representing the appellant in this matter. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal.
Yes, sir.
Virginia Code Section 65-2-701A specifically mandates that the commission only approve agreements if it is clearly of the opinion that the best interests of the employee or his dependents will be served thereby. If the commission does not approve proposed agreements, then they are void. The statute does not include approval based solely on the proposed agreements being technically correct. In this case, the record is clear that a set of proposed agreements submitted to the commission for approval in January of 2006 were not approved by the awards unit. Instead, the matters were referred to the hearing docket. As such, the proposed agreements became void. An award order of the commission may only be ended, diminished, or increased if a party files a timely application for hearing on a change of condition pursuant to Virginia Code 65.2-708.
Mr. Sweeney, do you agree or disagree that everyone in this case up until the time of the discrepancy was found was working under the assumption that the agreement was valid and that the matter was done?
I do not agree, Your Honor.
And what fact did you point to?
Well, first of all, Your Honor, we never knew that the agreements were submitted to the commission until 2013. We only submitted them to the insurance carrier. The insurance carrier apparently, we discovered in 2013, filed them with the commission without advising us that they had done so.
Didn't both parties act as if the termination agreement had been entered?
They did not, Your Honor, because what happened was there was a stipulation entered into by the parties where the defense represented the employer here that did not provide for termination of the award. If the agreements had been submitted and approved by the commission, then the result would have been the issuance of a supplemental award. That's the alert to everybody that the agreements have been approved. That never occurred, and that was obvious by the time the stipulation was entered into in 2006 that no supplemental award had been entered. And so when the stipulation is completed and doesn't address that award remains outstanding. As if that was not enough, then in 2007, the commission sends out a letter saying the award is still open. You have to do something if that's not correct. And they don't do anything. So if that doesn't tell the employer at that point that the commission still has on record that the award is outstanding, then those agreements obviously have not been approved and no result have not resulted in a supplemental award. If that's not enough, it happens again in 2008. The commission again notifies the parties that the award is still outstanding. So clearly, in 2006, 2007, 2008, the commission believes that the award is still in effect. And that's, in fact, true. And the defendants have admitted that in their request for admission, that that was still a valid award. So to say that the parties intended, or rather acted as if the award was closed is incorrect. In fact, in 2013, when the claimant withdraws her approval to the agreements, if the agreements had been approved, if the agreements were valid, she would not have been able to withdraw them. But she, in fact, did withdraw them and did seek enforcement of her award. Therefore, she's entitled to the benefits under that award. And the case law is quite clear about that. The fact that the award was never terminated by the commission, either by approving agreements or by some supplemental decision based upon an employer's application for hearing, means that award remains in effect. And that's no different than an order of the circuit court. It remains in effect. It's subject to collection. It's subject to action. The example I use of the circuit court is 20 years. It doesn't matter that you wait until the 19th year to enforce the order, to enforce the judgment, the debt still remains, and that's what happened in this case.
In this case, the claimant does not allege that the agreement is a product of any mistake or fraud. She acknowledges that the time she entered the agreement, it was a consent agreement, and she anticipated that the agreement was going to be entered by the commission.
Partly correct. If the timing is critical here, because at the time the agreements were submitted, the employer had already unilaterally ceased compliance with the award in August of 2005. The agreements don't come into play until late 2005 and are actually filed by the carrier in 2006. It is correct that we did send them to the carrier's representative with the intention that they be approved by them, and then if they were going to approve them, then submit them to the commission. They didn't tell us that they did that, but that's not enough, because if it was simply a matter of sending in what they call the technically correct agreement forms, that would be like saying if I submitted to the circuit court an order that was technically correct, signed by both parties, it doesn't require any action by the circuit court. It doesn't require a signature of the judge. It's enforceable. And that is not the law. And that's not the law of workers' compensation, and it's certainly not the law of the Commonwealth. So the fact that those agreements were signed, even if at that time it was intended to be filed, is really no longer relevant. The example is the same employer took that very same position in Fairfax County School Board versus Humphrey, where they said, we signed agreements at the time we intended to be bound by those agreements. We voluntarily entered into those agreements. We submitted those to the commission. Ah, but wait, we just decided we changed our mind. We don't want to be bound by that agreement. We revoke those agreements. And the commission upheld that revocation because the intent of the parties at the time they signed the paperwork is not dispositive. If it was, there would be no opportunity to vacate or to withdraw. And furthermore, the provisions of 701A, which say that this must be approved by the commission if it's in the best interest of the claimant, would be a nullity. It would have no effect whatsoever.
Let's take your example to another degree. Suppose in your traditional case where there's compensation, let's just call it a regular personal injury case, make it simple. And suppose the parties had come to an agreement that for the injuries that were sustained by the plaintiff in the action, the defendant agrees to pay $100,000. And you enter the settlement agreement, you sign the papers indicating that that's what you're going to do. And because an action was pending, you say to the court, we've settled the matter, and we signed a settlement agreement, and we want you to confirm it through the entry of an order. And the judge says, glad the case is settled, I donn't want to try it in the first place, which is not unusual. So then, the defendant pays the money, the insurance company pays the money, $100,000. The person who's the plaintiff receives the money, they spend the money. Turns out 6-7 years later, turns out that for whatever reason, clear or whatever, the judge never entered the order. Could the plaintiff then come back and say, well, I had an action pending, and now I've kind of thought about it, that $100,000 that I got wasn't really enough, and I actually want to go forward now on my case?
That's an interesting position, but it doesn't apply here for this reason. I've actually had this happen in my experience in trial practice, where we've entered into an agreement to a settlement, plaintiff entered into a settlement, the Maryland attorney who didn't realize it was binding at the time in Virginia, and of course then said, oh, wait a minute, I've bound myself to this whole case, but I've only settled with one defendant, I want to get out of this, and of course the court said no. When you enter into a settlement in a personal injury case, that's a binding agreement, and there's detrimental reliance. That's not the case in a workers' compensation case. Even if there is a compromised settlement of the entire claim, it is not binding until the commission approves it. The commission must approve it. And 701A requires the commission to approve agreements, and if it does not, the statute specifically says they are void. Therefore, the difference is that in the example that you give, it's finalized by the settlement, and then it becomes a matter of the court signing the order. That's a different situation than here, where the submission of the agreements to the commission still requires action by the commission. If the commission doesn't act, then the agreements are void, and that's exactly what happened in this case.
The answer would be that the personal injury action actually became a contract action by the
Correct. And it became finite, because at that point it ended. But in the compensation world, it continues to accrue until either circumstances change or you end up at the end of 500 weeks. And that's why this, if I can use the example, the meter was running on this case when the stipulation was entered into, when the commission issued its letters in 2007 and 2008, and even in 2013. And the problem is that if the employer had, upon our actions in 2013, taken the steps that it should have taken, which was to file an employer's application for hearing, it still would have been required to pay the benefits to the claimant from 2005 to 2011. That is correct, Your Honor. And the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals and the Commission have made that very clear, that in that situation, the employer who fails to file an application on change of condition, is required to pay up until 2 years before they file that application. That's established and well-settled law. So in this case, if the employer had decided in 2013 to file an employer's application, they still would have had to have paid from 2005, whatever shortage there was in 2005, up until 2011, 2 years before they filed the application. They didn't do it.
Now, so you're in a rebuttal time. Obviously, you can continue if you'd like, but I didn't want to inform you that you're in a rebuttal time.
Oh, I'd rather wait for my rebuttal time.
Yes,
thank
sir.
You.
Good morning, Your Honors. Michael Salveson for Fairfax County School Board. This is a case where the commission simply made a mistake. The commission acknowledged that it made a mistake. The commission acknowledged that the cause of its mistake was really just an odd, random coincidence. The same day they received the fully executed agreement forms, which took the temporary total award first to temporary partial and then to closure, they also received, in the same case, a medical expense claim that sought payment of some medical expenses. The
Mr. Sweeney has suggested to this court that despite all those things, which obviously did occur, that the agreement that was anticipated, and I'm going to use the word to make my question, did not become an agreement that was enforceable by a commission unless and until the commission signed off on it, and based upon the fact that they had not signed off on the termination, then the matter was not closed.
The commission neither approved nor rejected those agreements. You're right. If for the award to be technically modified, the commission has to take action. But the commission had, and this court has, another option in this case, and that is imposition. When a mistake imposes an unfair result on the parties, the commission has the power, equitable power, to do full and complete justice in an unusual case like this one. And this is certainly an unusual case. It's been argued that the doctrine of imposition only applies when the claimant has engaged in some kind of unfair conduct. That's really not so. The commission can correct its own mistakes, as it did, or as this court affirmed in the King case. The commission has the power to do full and complete justice. In this case, what the commission did is it looked at the intent of the parties, and it looked at the agreements they had signed, and it looked at what happened for 8 years after the agreements were signed, and it concluded that full and complete justice in this case was to give effect to the agreement of the parties.
So would you suggest as a standard of review with regard to our considering the commission's position or applying the doctrine of the position? What is the standard of review?
Well, it's within the discretion of the commission to make these equitable remedies. I think it's reviewable for abuse.
And the standard hasn't really been particularly articulated in any case, has it?
I'm not sure that it has. But the employer tried to do the right thing in this case. The employee had an accident. The employer accepted liability for the accident as required under Section 701 of the code. The employer offered an award agreement, and an award was entered. The claimant returned to work in May of 2005 in a reduced hour capacity, and she worked in a reduced capacity for 3 months and then went back to a full capacity in August. As it was entitled to do, the employer stopped paying as of the return to work, sent her agreement forms, and this is most of the commission's business, as your honors well know, is done by agreement. There's not, we don't litigate 90% of these cases. Most of it is done by agreement. If we have to litigate it, we look to Rule 1.4, which says if you file an application for hearing that says that the claimant has returned to work, you must pay compensation through the date of the return to work. So as a practical matter, what people often do is when they learn of a return to work, they suspend compensation until they can get the agreements filed. If it looks like there's a problem, file the application.
Mr. Sweeney's response to my hypothetical when I was talking about the traditional personal injury case and the settlement of that was that there's always, in those cases, some level of detrimental reliance. Are you able to, in the context of this case, talk about any detrimental reliance that your client had based upon what you termed the clerical error?
Well, we certainly acted and assumed as if the award had been terminated. We did get the open award letter later, and you know, that's in the record. We acknowledge that. But what the open award letter says is the commission assumes payments are continuing if payments have ceased, an executed termination of wage loss award or an application, either or, must be filed to end the award. We had already filed the executed termination of wage loss award form, and the full commission, in fact, at page 1500 of the appendix, they found that we had complied with the conditions set forth in the open award letters. So we did. The evidence shows that the claimant signed these agreement forms willingly. She agreed that she was signing because they were correct. She agreed that her wage loss benefits should be terminated. She admitted that when she signed the agreement, she acknowledged that she had received the compensation shown for the periods shown. She admitted that when she signed the termination form, she understood she was agreeing that she had returned to work and would not be receiving any more compensation benefits. And as a practical matter, she did return to work. She returned to work with Fairfax County Public Schools for 4 years. Then she worked for a neighboring school district. Then she came back as a substitute teacher for the Fairfax County Public Schools. She's worked the whole time. This is not a case where someone who has suffered disability and wage loss is being asked to forego compensation for that disability and wage loss. If the compensation sought in this case were to be awarded, it would turn the statute pretty much upside down.
Do you see this case as controlled at all by Lamb versus Lanier?
Well, certainly Lamb should advise your thinking, but honestly, the employer in this case did more than the employer in that case. That was a case where I think the employer received a letter saying that the person had returned to work and they requested further information, but that's all they did. They didn't circulate agreement forms. They certainly didn't file signed agreement forms. They didn't file an application for hearing. And even so, only making an inquiry, what are you earning? This court applied the doctrine of imposition and corrected that error. Same thing happened in King. Same thing happened in Collins. I am not aware of any case in which the employer did as much as the employer did in this case, and the doctrine of imposition was not invoked, and an equitable remedy was not imposed. There is a due process issue that we haven't touched upon. I don't know whether the claimant will address it in the rebuttal time, but I think I should probably address it. There is some thought that this result in this case deprives the claimant of the right to file for additional compensation. If the commission had done the right thing in the first place and acknowledged the agreement of the parties, and if the award had been officially terminated back in 2005, there's a period of time within which a change in condition claim can be filed. And there is an argument that this denies that right. In fact, the issue of further disability and further wage loss was addressed at the hearing, and the evidence doesn't provide any support for any change in condition claim. We had a full evidentiary hearing. In fact, in the colloquy before the questioning of the witnesses began, claimant's counsel acknowledged that this issue of the change in condition being foreclosed was of concern. Had the claimant been able to prove a further period of disability or wage loss, I think the equitable powers of the commission would have allowed them to accommodate that. If, for instance, The evidence had showed that 6 months after she returned to work, she again became disabled as a result of that same accident and missed another 2 weeks of work. I think the commission could have incorporated that into its equitable remedy in this case. Certainly there was an opportunity to be heard. Commissioner Newman even made fun of us a little bit about the lengths of the briefs. He said that we were the poster children for page limitations, and he may be right there. But there is no basis for a subsequent award. There's no basis. There's 50-some-odd pages of medical evidence submitted by the claimant. None of it shows subsequent disability as a result of this accident. She did have two subsequent work accidents, one in 2005, one in 2008, plus other non-work-related health problems, which may have caused her to miss some work. There is no medical evidence showing that she experienced any further period of disability or wage loss that would have been foreclosed by the closure of the award. This is a perfect case for imposition. As I said, this employer did more to comply with the act than any employer I've seen in an imposition case. And I have seen the remedy of imposition and equitable remedy denied occasionally, but never to anyone who did anywhere near as much as this employer did. We were not required to file an application for hearing. That is one of the ways to change an award, but agreements that were fully executed and proper, the commission found that they were that they were correct. They neglected to process them due to the arrival of two communications on the same day. There's also been some suggestion that maybe the agreement forms were referred to the hearing docket. That's not the case. It wouldn't have made any sense. The agreement forms said what they said. It was clear when you look at the notice of referral of application to hearing docket that what was referred was, in fact, the medical provider application. There's a little stamp on the letter application at page 15 of the appendix. I don't want to tempt you to pick it up. It's an enormous appendix. But the claims division stamps it and then makes a little note in it, referred to hearing docket, and that's what it says on the medical provider claim, not on the agreements. The agreements just have a plain receipt stamp, and then what became of them after that, I honestly do not know. But this really is, from the claimant's standpoint, this is not something she expected. She testified that she expected to close the award, that she expected her benefits would stop, that she acknowledged that she had received the money she had acknowledged, she acknowledged that she had returned to work. As far as she was concerned, I think she was satisfied that she had gotten what the Act provided for her and that those benefits were done. But when this opportunity presented itself, when it became apparent that the commission had made a mistake and that these forms were lying, I think somebody said they were lying fallow in the commission's file, that presented an opportunity. There's never been any disagreement with what's on those agreement forms. The claimant did not testify, oh, I want to revoke my consent because they're wrong or because of anything except that she could. That's why she revoked her consent to those agreement forms. That would be a harsh and random and unwarranted outcome in this case. If the commission's mistake were permitted to result in a windfall, a sort of a lottery ticket, amounting to something like $500,000, I think, in this case. But this court has the power to do full and complete justice. The commission already invoked that power and did it. I urge you to agree with them and to affirm this case. In the event that you do not affirm this case, I'm sure that your honors are all aware of this, but there are a whole bunch of defenses that were never addressed by the commission. This would be have to be a remand case for consideration of those defenses. There, we had so many, I actually wrote them down and put them in the record, page 1053 and 1054.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of points. First of all, let me address the issue of signing off on the agreement forms. With all due respect, more than that is required. It's not simply a matter of a stamp saying they're approved. The 701A requires the commission to make a decision that it is in the best interest of the employee to approve the agreements. That has never been addressed by the commission in its opinion. And in fact, that was referred to in the dissent from Commissioner Marshall. He made the point that the commission, in its majority opinion, never addresses the statutory requirement of 701A. The due process argument is critical because all of these arguments about no evidence, the claimant will, if this decision stands, will never get to address, because all the time limits for her to do so would have expired as a result of this decision being made retroactive. So she is precluded from any further benefits by making this decision retroactive, and that was not the issue that was we went to a hearing on. You don't have to, when you're under an award, the change in condition responsibility falls on the employer, not the employee. The employee who's under an award doesn't have to come in and say, oh, by the way, there may be something else I'm entitled to. I have to put on evidence to that fact. In fact, if you file with the commission and there's an open award, they'll reject your application. This mistake issue is really bothers me. It bothers me because there is no factual basis on which to conclude that there was a mistake. The only thing that the employer has and that the commission has is the stamp that shows that these two sets of documents, meaning the claim for medical benefits and the agreement forms, were stamped by the same mail clerk on the same day. We don't know if they were received at the same time. All we know is they were stamped on the same day. To assume that somehow that's confusing isn't supported by the record, because what the record shows is the claim for medical benefits was referred to the department DR. I don't know what DR stands for. I'm going to guess it's something like docket review. And that then is referred to the hearing docket. At the same time, the two agreement forms are submitted to the awards unit.
What would you suggest is the standard of review with regard to whether or not we should uphold the commission's adherence to the doctrine of imposition?
Your Honor, I would cite you to Uninsured Employers Fund versus Peters, in which it states, imposition cannot be invoked to reward a party who blatantly contravenes the Act's requirements on the rationale that the outcome would have been the same if the Act's requirements had been followed. The Commission's authority to do full and complete justice must be exercised within the principles established by statutes and rules construing them. In addition, the doctrine of imposition cannot be used to overrule the mandates of a statute. And for that matter,
I hear you just say that you think that it's something close to abuse of discretion.
It might be close to that, yes, because clearly the factual evidence, the record, their own file does not justify mistake. If I would cite you also to page 1107 of the appendix, which is the awards unit paperwork that shows how they process separately and independently the agreement forms, it clearly says still needs a hearing and says referred to a docket. So I disagree with my esteemed colleague here, that in fact they did refer those agreement forms to the hearing docket. So we had the claim for medical benefits and we had the hearing forms both going to the docket.
What about the Lamb case?
The Lamb case has been distinguished. It's distinguished in Uninsured Employers Fund versus Peters. It was distinguished in Genesis. It really is not a case that necessarily applies to the facts here. Because, again, what the commission is doing, and it's an interesting thing, if you look at what the commission has done with imposition, they don't require the doctrine of imposition to correct a mistake. And yet they're trying to use the doctrine of imposition to correct what they've created is a mistake. But in fact, the record doesn't substantiate that there was a mistake, and Commissioner Marshall, in his dissent, makes that point. On the point of detrimental reliance, There, in fact, was detrimental reliance on the part of the claimant because being under an award, she didn't have to take any steps to file any change of condition applications or to seek anything further because she was already under an award. So there, in fact, was detrimental reliance by the claimant on the award that the commission still had as outstanding. So I think that, and also it's not true that she worked the whole time. The medical record doesn't support that. So I think what's critical here is the commission going to be allowed to avoid 701A, avoid its own Rule 1.4, and avoid the case law that says in this situation, when the employer doesn't do what the employer is supposed to do, not once, not twice, not three times, but four different times, then they should not be rewarded by being relieved of their responsibilities under the Act.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time has expired. We will move to the next. We'll come down to the end of our policy in brief.
Thank you.